Welcome to the Muslim Sheroes of Minnesota podcast, where we spotlight the Muslim women of the Minnesota community. My name is Noshina Hussein, and I'm the executive director of RISE, Reviving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment. Our mission is to amplify the voice and power of Muslim women through storytelling, leadership development, and civic engagement. What is a Shiro? A Shiro is a female trailblazer who is creating change in her community. She takes risks, she challenges misconceptions, and addresses injustices. Shiros are on a mission to build a better world, and the sisterhood is here to support them and lift their voices. Meet our next Shiro, Nemo Omer. Nemo is an activist turned organizer. When she saw the injustices occurring in her community, she didn't just stand on the sidelines, she joined the movement. She understands the power of collective organizing, and she fights for workers' basic human rights. Listen to her tell her story in her own words.
There was a training that happened in November of 2015. From 2016, I believe. During the weekend, I was at a momentum training. My advocacy work was kind of shifting, right? So I was doing, you know, policy work and was like so excited to do this work. And then I was invited to attend momentum. Momentum training is a training that helps people train to mobilize in mass movements, right? It trains people in different circles, like people, undocumented folks, Black folks in the community, women, feminist groups that people are trying to advocate in different aspects. And so kind of Wall Street, Occupy Homes. And so there's so many different people, so many different groups trying to mobilize and organize folks, right, in different ways. So it was a beautiful room. I've never been part of it. I was so interested and I wanted to do more, right? And that hunger came because seeing this thing at a very young age and realizing that there is so much that needs to be done, right? And so that weekend, I was, it was in Northeast Minneapolis, where the training was held. And Sunday morning, I walked in the room and I noticed that everyone was crying. And I'm just like, what is going on? And this is a 3-day train, so it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And Sunday was the last day, so I'm coming in so excited, you know. And everyone was just crying, and I'm just like, well, what is going on? I came in late, so I was like, I don't know what's going on, I don't know what's happening, why is everyone crying? And they made an announcement saying, last night we had, less than 2 miles away, a Black man was shot in the head, and all the witnesses were there. And so people were like, "We need to do something." And so basically, we had to put everything we learned in the last 2 days in action on the third day. Like literally, it was a test. And so I was like, "I don't know who the person is. Like, what's going on?" And so we dropped everything down. We left the room, got another room, and started to craft and begin a plan on what to do. And the guy that got shot was Jamar Clark. Basically, we came up with a plan and we started to say, let's do a no-cop zone. So people in the community are feeling, because what happened is when he was shot, the cops confiscated the tapes that were caught. And so we were like, let's protect the witnesses in the community and let's create a no-cop zone. So what happened was we drafted and came up with a plan and we're like, okay, let's do this. So everyone got their items. We marched to where he was shot, which is like a couple blocks from the 4th precinct. And we created like a circle and we held hands and he said, no cops in. So after time went on, people were like, let's go march down to the precinct and ask for the cops, you know, ask for my answers. The family wanted answers, like what's going on. And it's crazy because the press release and the news that were coming out of from the officers and the witnesses were not correlating. We were not the same. So inconsistent. And so people were saying he was handcuffed and was shot, you know, in the back of his head, shot in the back. And so I was one of the first 10, 15 people that sat in the festival that night and said, we're not moving until we get these three demands. Release the tapes. Also have Betsy Hodges, who was a mayor at the time, say something or do something around this issue. And then 3, I don't remember at the time, it was something around suspend or I don't know, fire the cops, something around the lines. I don't remember because we were just so frustrated because we're like, we need answers. And the community were relying on the leaders and the organizers to help solve the problem. So in that moment, that time led to 18-day occupation at the 4th precinct, which held down, really doing the work. Also, we had one of the nights where the white supremacist came and shot up the group. Unfortunately, I was doing security that night, and I was the person who confronted one of the men who shot us, who's not convicted. And so I remember saying, "Hey, you need to go away, or else you're causing some troubles." And so I witnessed a lot in that period of time. I was able to then articulate what police brutality means in the lens of like Black communities, right? And so, yeah, and really a lot of that advocacy work that I was doing on a higher education level has transitioned to some of my activism work, right? Because of I accidentally was in a training that led to be a fourth priest, to then be an ATV occupation, and then so on and so forth. And that's when a lot of my activism and my politicization has begun. I was politicized in that moment, right? And I was learning things that I have never knew about, right? And I was learning about how to deal with cops and how cops are dealing with folks and just the violence on Black lives, you know, and in Black communities on police brutality. And just so much that was opened for me. And after that, I was introduced to so many different movements, so many different people across the country, so many different places, attending conferences, meeting new people, meeting Tamir's wife's mother, meeting so many humans that have been impacted on police brutality, and that has really changed my life forever because I was able to see and experience the violence firsthand. Obviously, the verdict came out, and the cops were acquitted, and a lot of folks were just really frustrated. And there was a moment where I served as the Black Lives Matter core team. So it was a core team on BLM Minneapolis. So I served on with those core leaders to kind of figure out what was the next plan. You know, what is the next plan for BLM? What's the next plan for Black people in the state of Minnesota? And so there was a lot of rough time, people were just not, coming together in ways that we should have, right? And so I was still always doing the work and organizing acts and doing work. I joined Momentum, so I was the facilitator of Momentum for a bit, doing facilitation work in South Carolina and North Carolina, kind of helping that out. And so in that moment, I was called upon, I was called from a friend and said, "Hey, there's a struggle going on in the airport in Minneapolis. And East African workers, majority of the East African workers, working class folks, are struggling to basically unionize there. And so there was a campaign going on." And so during that time, I was called on for a month to help. And so I was able to, in that month, really help out the East African community, predominantly the Somali community. And obviously, by the mercy of God, I was like successful in really making sure that happened, really making sure that their voices were heard in that moment. And within that month period, we were able to successfully win the contract for them, right? And so even though I was not doing activism, that changed to organizing, because then I was organizing on really making change in people's lives. And so that's how I kind of moved from activism to like advocacy activism and then to organizing labor. Being an activist and being an organizer and being an advocate, extremely different things and extremely different responsibilities in terms of the impact. We all need those different layers, but it's so different. I now am able to articulate that fighting for justice is a privilege. It's a privilege within themselves. You have people all across the country, all across the world, struggling to fight for justice, who are struggling to change lives, right? There's places in the world where if you speak out, for example, even Ethiopia, you can't demonstrate. If you do, you will get killed or you'll be jailed, right? If you make a speech that is contradicting to the president or to the political power, you will be jailed. You will be punished for that. And one thing that I always say is that I'm not interested if we stood with the great. I'm interested if we sat with the broken. It's not. It's a quote by an anonymous person. So I don't know who it's by. So I'm able to understand like the work that I'm doing is a privilege and that can be taken away any minute. Doing this work really makes you humble. It really humbles you to because you're working with one of the, probably the most vulnerable people in a community, who don't know language, who are not documented, who don't know how to drive, who don't speak the language. Like, you know, there's so much, and you just sit back and be like, wow. I think one thing that I'm most proud of is seeing the change my work has been able to impact workers. There was this young man who walked in our doors at the Wood Center, and he was like so pessimistic about the organizing efforts. He was just like, this is dumb, this is not going to do anything. I don't know why you guys keep inviting me to meetings, it doesn't make sense. And seeing him grow into become a leader and organizer at his workplace has just, it feels like a huge accomplishment. Because this man, this young man, who has now left Amazon, he was an Amazon worker, is now working at a different place, and he was at one of our last meetings last month, or the month before, and he was giving a speech about like how he was so grateful about knowing his rights, because he didn't know his rights as a worker at the workplace, and how he was so thankful for one of our Know Your Rights trainings, and he said, you know, he was telling us a story, but I don't know in that moment if he knew, but he was organizing. So he went to his work, he was able to organize his workers to talk about a really toxic, abusive boss, and then that boss was eventually fired. He didn't know, but he was actually organizing. And seeing that and learning that in that moment, just like, I was about to cry. It was like one of the most powerful moments, because he will continue to do that and eventually teach other workers to do that. And that itself is just so amazing. I think a lot of the times, a lot of people romanticize people in the past and amazing leaders. And that's, I think, it's amazing within itself. But I think I want to uplift local women right now that are living, breathing, that are doing the work. The quote of Malcolm X comes to mind, right? Of, you know, Black women are the most disrespected women, people in America, right? And one thing that Islam tells us in the story of Prophet Abraham, right? Of his wife Hajra was a Black woman, right? And one thing about Islam, Hajj, when you're performing the pilgrimage, there's a step in the cycle of the, where you have to go through. It's called Safa wal Marwa. You have to run and perform the same steps that Hajra, the Black woman, Prophet Abraham's wife, did. And the fact that we know that we believe that Prophet Muhammad was descended from Abraham, and so he would not exist if there was that Black woman, right? And so we hold so much resilience and courage. If we learn from the pious predecessors, we learn from the history. And so one thing I want Black or just Muslim women in general is that we may not be seen as humans, maybe even subhumans right now in this country. And narrative that's out around Muslim women that we're oppressed, that we're, you know, we're not worthy of anything, or, you know, Ilhan Omar being, you know, crucified right now in her position, is that we are, Muslim women are resilient, they have the courage, and never, ever, ever wait, in the words of Ilhan, never, ever wait for anyone to tell you to take up space, take that piece up yourself, right? And so we live in a country where we have the freedom and the privilege to fight for justice. And I think one thing I would tell about Muslims is that we don't have the luxury to sit around anymore. We don't have the luxury to wait and to wait for a perfect time to do something. Take that ni'mah, that blessing, and really make sure that you're making change in your circles. There's one thing that, there's this amazing saying, in a hadith where the Prophet saw a man strolling in heaven, like just walking around, and he asked, what was the purpose of, like, how did he get the Jannah? How did he get to heaven? And he got to heaven because he took a small action of removing a tree that might harm any other human being. Don't ever overlook the small deed of the action. You never know what, even just removing a branch off a tree, removing some kind of harm you know, harmful item, you know, on the road or whatever. Don't ever overlook that, and really make sure that everything you do it with the right intention of helping and serving other folks, serving other people, and never overlook the deed, because any small deed can gain you the pleasure of God.
Thank you to Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota for funding the Shiro's Project. To learn more about Shiro's and Reviving Sisterhood, visit us at www.revivingsisterhood.org. Find us on social media at Reviving Sisterhood on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you!